The return of wolves to the wild in our part of the world is viewed with both excitement and trepidation. Wolves were once a key part of the ecosystem, but they are a top predator. And there's something above them on the food chain, which explains why they disappeared from our landscape for decades. Humans as super predators is the general cast of a new report by a group of scientists showing how heavy is the hand of humans hunting and fishing. The report in the August 21st issue of the journal Science is called The Unique Ecology of Human Predators, and one of the four authors is Dr. Tom Reimken, who's a biologist at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, who was our guest on The Exchange. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Reimken.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Some of the terms themselves would seem to require a little bit of explanation up front, like sustainable exploitation.
Typically, that's meant to sort of embrace the utilization of some prey item for our purposes that can withstand that level of extraction into the indefinite future without sort of compromising the rest of the community.
Right, so the animals can be taken and not diminished over time.
Correct, yeah.
Sustainable exploitation. You point out early on in this report that there have been other reports, lots of them. What differs in your approach to this particular one?
Yeah, it's sort of, we tried a meta-analysis, basically went to scour the literature and went through about 2,200 different cases of looking at this exploitation rate of natural predators, of how many of their prey do they take sort of in natural systems, and then on different continents. And then we did the same for how much humans take on different continents with different types of prey, whether it be ungulates or fish, etc. And then we did these comparisons between sort of the natural predator consumption and our consumption, and that's what emerged from that was this sort of remarkable disconnect between what natural predators do and what we do.
You cite numbers in hunting and in fishing. Was there any inclusion of animals used for food from agriculture? I mean, farmed animals, that sort of thing?
No, we didn't actually include any of the domestic species at all. So,
okay, so I just wanted to make that clear up front. So we're talking about hunting and fishing here. Let's start with the hunters. On land, how do we compare with other predators?
Well, it's actually pretty close. When we look overall for any species comparison between what we take, how many deer, white-tailed deer, black-tailed, et cetera, compared to the natural predators. So it's pretty close overall. We tend, however, to target what we call the reproductive capital, and that is the adults, the larger individuals, and predators tend to target the young, the babies, the reproductive interest. And so it, even though the overall quota is comparable, sort of the impact actually on the prey population is substantially different.
That's an interesting concept, the capital and the interest. So in essence, a lot of other predators tend to take the smaller, the slower, the sicker, and we tend to go for the top of things.
Yes, that's correct, and it's right across the board, whether it be sort of Dungeness crabs, you know, through to lions, through to sort of basically Atlantic cod. It's a pretty widespread differentiation between us and them, so to speak.
There's a term I'm trying to figure out in the report, shared prey within the same community, and what that term means.
Well, that, for example, salmon on our coast, we obviously are important users, but so are seals and sea lions and orca, et cetera. So these are the shared prey that you have multiple different predators sort of targeting.
All right. So that leads us then into talking about aquatic and marine creatures. I mean, is that where the major impact difference is between us and the other predators?
Yes, absolutely. It's sort of, and it's where the drawdown of the total marine resources have been sort of most dramatic in terms of all those species that we've been targeting. And it's sort of, we basically sort of find that on average it's about 14 times the rate that humans are taking relative to natural predators of the adult prey. And because it's really not economical for us to go towards the younger, you know, the juveniles, et cetera, just by the sheer cost of actually having to capture these, we tend to obviously target the larger individuals. And so when we make a direct comparison between the proportion of those large individuals, this is the reproductive capital, and those that predators take, like sea lions, etc., we get on average is 14 times higher for what we're extracting.
We are talking about humans as super predators in a report in the August 21st issue of the journal Science called The Unique Ecology of Human Predators. Dr. Tom Reimken at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, one of the four authors with Chris Darimont, Carolyn Fox, and Heather Bryan. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the impact of humans as predators, as hunters, as fishers. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I guess there was not a whole lot of historical stuff to look at here, but any reason to believe humans have ever been different? I mean, when we didn't have guns and big nets, for example, I mean, were we pretty much like the other predators, having to catch the ones that straggled behind the bigger, faster ones?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously it's in that direction, but I think even what we know back into the our early sister groups, etc., Neanderthal, etc., we can see that they were already targeting the larger ungulates, while the predators that they coexisted with in Europe, these were the lions, the wolves, etc., when you look at the fossil or the cave skeletal material, these natural predators were taking young individuals at that time, and Neanderthal were taking, obviously, the largest individuals. So it obviously has gone on a long time, right? And if you go back far enough, clearly just the technology would be so simple that we would have probably taken what's easiest to get, and that would have been the young individuals.
Huh. Well, that's an interesting thing to think about, and probably beyond the scope of this report, though, is that it sounds like it's been for many, many, many ages that that what became human beings thought in terms of, like, ooh, there's a big one. Let's go after that one.
Yeah, when human population density was low, then it really did not have a major impact like now, right? Because we were taking probably 5% of that. I just pulled that number out of the air, but 5% of any prey biomass, which is sort of comparable to what normal predators would consume in a community that has lots of different predator species.
All right, so again, on land, it's pretty close in the amount of biomass we take, but we're just taking different individuals.
Yes, so that's the major differentiation. And the other thing is that we prey and predators have developed, you know, over millions of years, and sort of prey have all these defenses that they have to sort of try to circumvent the predators, etc., whether it be maybe their coloration or their speed or their size. This is part of that, those co-evolutionary associations. So what makes us particularly unusual is that we'd have been able to, of course, circumvent virtually every single defense that these prey have, whether it be schooling, body size, etc. So we're immediately imposing a fundamentally different sort of regime, so to speak, on these natural prey.
One of the quotes that jumps out at me was, remarkably, hunters exploited large carnivores at 3.7 times the rate that they killed herbivores. What's surprising about that?
Yeah, well, just we normally are not eating carnivores, et cetera, and so it's likely that these are happening because we're trying to eliminate competitors in the same way that on our coast some 5 decades ago they used to have bounties for sea lions and seals because they consumed the same resources we did. And so if we would have had access to that type of information, we would have been able to see very high exploitation rates or kill rates of these other competitors because they were utilizing the same resource. So that's certainly part of the interpretation.
So, Dr. Reimken, in this report, do you make any distinctions between hunting for sport and hunting for food?
Oh, there are subtle differences for sure. It's really sort of in some ways secondary to the bigger picture here of the overall exploitation rate. I can sort of emphasize the issue of the are targeting the largest individuals, whether it be sports or commercial. If I can give you an example, just something like in some of these fish.
Sure.
We catch, obviously, the biggest fish we can, for example, herring, which can live for 8 to 10 years. If a herring gets to about a little over a foot in size, a female will produce 20,000 eggs. You know, consider that the interest. But if we let them live one more year, and they really only put on 1 inch or so. The next year, they're producing 30,000 eggs. And there's multiple examples here where when we target the largest individual, so we obviously, our regulations require that we let go of the little ones, right? Another example is the yellowtail rockfish. You know, a 1 foot yellowtail has 50,000 eggs, but if it just doubles, not even doubles in size, 50% increase in size, it produces 600,000 eggs. And so you can see what happens if, for some species where there's lots of individuals that breed every year, right, by hunting and taking out, obviously, the largest individuals, we have so compromised that capacity for production of biological interest, right? And yet we've turned it upside down to the extent where we can't keep the young ones. We keep the adults that are producing these 500,000 eggs. So this is sort of the one of the more important themes that differentiate whether it be sort of the sports or commercial extraction.
It's the idea of eating your seed corn, in essence, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
All right, so we're eating the stuff that could feed us for generations down the road. Are there practicable ways, though, to go ahead and change that, particularly when we're dealing with things that we catch in nets that would seem to let the big ones get in and let the little ones out?
Yeah, I mean, these are technical issues, and already there are in place means of sort of minimizing capture of the largest individuals. One of the better cases is the lobster fishing on the east coast of Canada, and a lobster pot basically has these two little round entrances, and these entrances have a diameter that basically excludes, right, anything above a certain size, which in that particular case is designed to exclude the reproductive adults. And so you end up basically generating, you've had a very successful, very sustainable long-term fishery on these lobsters because of this fundamental issue of excluding the reproductive adults. On our coast here, with the same thing could be done with Dungeness crabs. We know basically with these trawls, they now have video cameras that they can attach that basically control the opening and closing of these trawls underwater. And so you can basically, when you have target species in there, you can keep the net closed. If you get a species that's not wanted or the larger individuals, the net can be open. So there are these little technical issues. For rockfish, for example, obviously rockfish, you know, because of their swim bladder, if you bring them to the surface, you know, they basically will die if you release them because the swim bladder emerges from their mouth. But obviously, so how do you ever let a big individual go if it's going to die? Well, you have flexible hooks that basically flex with a particular force. And so in that way, that would facilitate, in fact, the capture of the smaller individuals. So I think there's technical solutions to all of these. They're not immediately in place for quite a few species, but I think if their society recognizes the requirement to shift to younger individuals with quotas that emulate those of natural predators, there'll be very quick technological adaptations to cope with that change.
So we do have some of the means at our disposal.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Dr. Tom Reimken, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, biologist at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. We're talking about humans as super predators. He is one of four authors of a report in the August 21st issue of Science called The Unique Ecology of Human Predators. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The major theme here seems to be in this quote here: an enormous and rapidly growing human population, demographically decoupled from dwindling prey. So unlike the days when we were hunter-gatherers and followed the herds around, we just don't have to, well, at least we haven't thought much about the fact that we are in the process of eliminating species that we could depend on for food.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, obviously our capacity to switch, you know, and typically when a predator draws its prey down, right, at a certain point, it no longer is effective, you know, for the predator to search out these relatively rare prey, and so it switches to the more common type. Well, we do the same thing, but because of our technology, we can draw down basically, as we can see, sort of an eastern on, in the Atlantic, to a species that is effectively ecologically extinct. And it's so easy, just by nature of our technology here, to make those shifts that other predators often don't even have that opportunity. Some species, if you remember some with the orca, that are specialists on Chinook salmon. It's not that they can go out and eat herring whenever they want. So these are specialists, and that sort of allows basically us with our technology, anything that gets drawn down, we shift to something else very quickly.
But they can't do that. But that references other issues of potential collapses in food chains that we have gotten into, where if we reduce the numbers of a certain species that is the only food source for another species, then maybe we didn't eat the prey of that particular predator, but we were eating the predator. And then with that predator, you see what I'm saying? All the interconnections here.
Oh, it's a very, very important point, and it's probably there's not a community, at least an aquatic community, anywhere on the planet that hasn't been negatively impacted by this precise issue that you just brought up. And when you have something like maybe 200 for our coast, for example, there's about 150 species that take salmon. And according to multiple reports, the abundance of salmon have been drawn down between 80 and 90% over the last 100 years. Well, if you've got obviously 150 species of other users of salmon, not of the adults, but of the young one, in which the total biomass of their prey have been drawn down literally 90% or 80%, the consequences of this at a sort of oceanic basin must be very, very substantive.
What kinds of responses are you getting to the report? I'm curious because, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here that I think we could have assumed already that we tend to take as humans a bit more beyond what we could eat at any particular time. And nobody ever talks about, gee, look at the small fish I get. Everybody talks about, look at this big fish I got, you know, which is, it's the human way, it seems. So, I mean, are there any, is anybody responding to this with a lack of surprise?
Well, certainly any ecologist would not be surprised by this, but fishery scientists, although they might not be surprised by our report, they would certainly not, I would say, give it much support, mainly because the whole fundamentals of fishery science is this whole concept of maximum yield per recruit, where you let things grow up to virtually adult size, and then you hit them, and so we expect to receive considerable scrutiny by the fisheries agencies, because it does sort of basically turn upside down many of the paradigms that have developed over the last 50 or 60 years in fishery science.
And I did notice some references in the report to disagreements on fisheries management. I mean, when reductions in fish take are proposed, are they still more than what you scientists would consider sustainable?
Oh, absolutely. So as we close off our paper, that it's already still four times higher than some of the most conservative conservation-managed fisheries in the world. And so it's basically they've come from the premise of complete lack of ecological sustainability progressively down to what they consider to be now almost a completely sort of conservative fishery, to the point that it has almost no impact. But when we look at that minimum rate that they are currently calculating, this is still four times higher than what we find among natural predators taking their prey. So we do have quite a ways to come yet to ultimately make this whole extraction, human extraction, ecologically sustainable at the level of the community.
So you're saying we have to make further reductions in what we're taking out of fisheries?
Absolutely.
And what's then the next step here? Because I noticed a couple of other papers involving you and some of the other people here. So what are some of the other things you're working on to further what you did with this particular report?
It's sort of we're trying to actually get at some of the simple methods by which we can encourage management to basically tweak the sort of exploitation sufficiently down that allows sort of the users, the human, the commercial fishing, the First Nations fishing, basically to modify their techniques, modify their methods that isn't going to yield sort of any type of economic calamity for the coastal peoples. And so these are little issues here that hopefully what will emerge from this report will be increased sensitivity, you know, to what really must ultimately turn out to be a significant reduction in overall quota and a shift in the size. So that's our one of our next points.
Any particular changes in hunting that that are advocated by this report?
Yeah. I guess throw away the gun and bring out the camera, at least with regard to the trophy hunting. That would be the obvious one that many others have suggested as well, you know, because for sure, if you target the best and the biggest, which is what we do with trophy hunting, not only the ecological but the evolutionary costs are very substantial. So there are things here in place that I think can readily be incorporated into without really seriously modifying ways of life, etc.
And lest anybody blanch at the idea of reading something in the journal Science, this is actually a fairly easy read and not a terribly long one at that. The report is called The Unique Ecology of Human Predators, written by Chris Darimont, Carolyn Fox, Heather Bryan, and our guest, Thomas Reimken, who is a biologist at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Tom, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much for the invite.
All right, take
Bye-bye.
Care.